We began chapter 4 of Wednesday night, and we've gone through discussions of the oppression and of envy and rivalry, and we know that all things are still vanity. We saw a few things that were better off in those circumstances. And we made it to, we were about to begin in verse 5. Chapter 4, verse 5. After discussing the rivalry and envy of neighbors, we discuss a few other lifestyles. And verse 5 through 6. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. I wanted to ask what lifestyles are being compared here?
Lazy worker.
Yeah, we have the lazy worker.
Well, with someone that works hard.
Lazy non-worker.
Yeah. Lazy with worker.
Yeah, and then someone else who does work. I guess we could call it an excess worker. Actually, there's three different lifestyles. I think three different lifestyles here. My second question sort of helps define that. You look at what does each one possess? What do they have in their hands? We see three different states of possession in someone's hands.
What they work for.
Yeah, but what are those three different states? What do these people possess in their hands?
One has nothing.
Yeah, one has empty hands. He doesn't have anything. That's the lazy man, slothful person we were talking about. What else?
One has a handful and is satisfied with it.
Yeah, one person has one handful. So one, a handful with quietness. And then the last person?
Works too much. Has two hands full.
Yeah, so there's the one that works too much. He has two hands full. So we have three different states of being here. Someone who folds their hands and has nothing. And then we have one person who has just one handful. And then one who's striving and toiling for the wind, and he has two hands full. And so we can, you know, label these if we want to as, you know, the lazy man, and then one is, you know, person who works in moderation, and then the I can't think of a good term, just the I guess the workaholic, the, you know, the excess worker. He's driving and working for so much, he's got his hands full.
workaholic.
Yeah, the workaholic. And what do we know of the outcome of each of these men? What do we know about each of these? Like the man who has nothing in his hands, what does it say of him?
Consumes him.
Yeah, consumes his own flesh. Of course, he's not, you know, consuming his own flesh sitting there, but we see that same thought in Ecclesiastes 10 and 18. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. And also, if you go back to Proverbs, in chapter 6, Proverbs 6, 9 through 11, "How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber. A little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man." We also see the same in chapter 24 of Proverbs, beginning verse 30. "I went by the field of the lazy man." In Proverbs 24, verse 30. "I went by the field of the lazy man, and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. And there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. When I saw it, I considered well. I looked on it and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, So shall your poverty come like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. Same we saw in that previous verse in Proverbs. You know, it's the consuming his own flesh is a matter of self-destruction. He's exchanged his future prosperity for a little bit of rest right now. You know, when the time comes to feed himself, he's not going to have it there. You know, he's giving away his future. And you look at the last, in verse 6, the last one, we were talking about the workaholic. What do we understand about him? You know, about his lifestyle. He's got two hands full, so he's got a lot, right?
Vanity.
It's not profitable in the long run. But he's better off, right? Because he still has more. He's better than the lazy man or the moderate man because he has the most, right? While he's here, he's the best. Is that the case? Sorry?
Not what Solomon says.
Yeah, not what Solomon says. And then how do we know that? What comes with having the most in this scripture?
No rest.
Mine has together with toil. He's got the most, but he's got the most toil for it. And, you know, you ask yourself, how much does a person need? You know, if you only need a handful, is two handfuls how's that gonna make you better off? With all this extra toil he's going through all this toil to get more, and there's only so much you really need.
Because my neighbor only had one handful, now I got two. Verse 4.
We've looked at that, and that's vanity and futility, right? I mean, even if you get you're better than, what do you get out of it? You don't really get anything better out of it at all.
Verse 8, says, for whom I labor and depriving myself.
This could be a wrong application, this could be a good application. But I think about one handful, two handful. Are you satisfied when you have one plate of food, or do you need two plates and you're going to hurt afterwards? Like, I just think
that's
about
a good
that.
Application. I one cook here too.
Yeah, exactly. There's a point when you have what you need, and any more doesn't help you anymore. Go ahead.
I just gotta say, if you eat one handful, you're satisfied, you enjoy yourself. But if you eat two handfuls of food, per se, your consequences may not be right then, but they're going to have them later on down the road. Because you're eating too much, it's going to have an effect on your life.
Yeah. That's only if you're eating too much. What if you just save that plate for later? You think it was bad, right? Yeah, you're not any better off with the more. And we see here, with having that greater amount, he has greater toil. And I don't want greater toil. I don't know. You want greater toil? It's, you know, there's a disadvantage there to it. He's increasing, you know, this toil for more, and that more doesn't even serve any purpose except he just has more, you know, just to see it with his eyes.
Practical application. My fault. Here a few months ago, we went down to Gallery Furniture. I think it was like 8 o'clock at night. Here's Mac, multi-millionaire. I'm down there working. He's in front of this. Yeah. Like, what for?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. He doesn't gain anything profitable out of it.
He gained as much prunes he didn't know he had it.
Maybe pride or more authority, sense of control that maybe fill a void or some, but yeah.
I think you're right to fill a void a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, for some people, work becomes a hobby. They have no outside hobbies.
Yeah.
They have no outside life, and so work becomes their hobbies, and their work comes off.
Yeah. So what do we see here in the scriptures? What is better? What's better than the lazy man? Better than the workaholic? Yeah, we see. That's correct. Yeah, better is a handful. All you need is a handful. Better just get that handful and stop with quietness. You don't have that excessive toil. You know, a little is better. A lot of times you hear, less is more. And if you look in Proverbs 15, you see sort of the same thought. You know, not directly applicable to this working, but in Proverbs 15, verse 16, we have better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. We're having a little different contrast here, but in some cases, less is more. It's better to have less. And also in verse 8 of chapter 16, better is a little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. And so, sometimes it's better to have a little less than take on these additional burdens, these additional sorrows. And that's exactly what we have here, is better just what you need to be satisfied than to take on sorrows of toil and grief and have absolutely no extra gain from it, no further reward. And when we move into verse 7, I've broken them apart, but they are in some sense the same thought here, you know, toiling and working. And Mr. Rosbach already pointed out, jumping ahead to verse 8, we see about those who toil and work with without companion. This one goes into a little bit more, but this one is greed, and it follows into the companionship. It's a good transitory point. In verse 7 through 8, Solomon makes another observation. He says, I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. And so we see here this the idea of this one alone is without companion. There's also a footnote that says without a second. He's without son nor brother. So, sisters don't count? Mm-hmm. We don't think that's what he's saying, is it? Mm-hmm. You look at back in Genesis 14, the use of the word brother. Go back in Genesis 14, it discusses Abraham and Lot. Verse 12, so this is when Lot was taken away by some raiders. They also took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And in verse 14, it says, now when Abraham heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his house and went in pursuit. And he calls Lot his brother. We see that verse just preceding it, was he really his brother? He was his Abraham's brother's son, which is, he's basically, it's brother is the term for kin. Or for relations, so it doesn't have to be a physical brother. So any kinfolk, any family, could be counted as a brother. And this man, he has none of that. He has no family, if you take it for that meaning. He has no son, he has no family, he has no companions. But why, the verses say why is this man alone? Is he just unlucky or unfortunate that his family passed away and now he's alone? Or is he incapable of maintaining friends, or is he somehow isolated? Maybe he lives out in the country. He lives in Alto. There's not many people out there. So he's all alone. Is that the case? Is that what we see?
No, he doesn't have time to make relationships.
Yeah, he doesn't have time. That's not his focus. We see what his... I'll answer both questions you want. Yeah, he doesn't have time. It's not his focus. He makes no time for friends or companions. And I had that next question. How does he spend his time? To help understand it. Yeah. What does he spend his time on? His work. Sorry, Max?
I was just saying gathering riches.
Yeah, gathering riches. Great still in his voice. Might sound like Max's talking. Yeah, he's his focus isn't on friends and relations and companionship. He doesn't waste time with that. He spends all his time on gathering riches. He says, you know, there is no end to his all his labors, and yet he has no family. He's no end to his labors, and his eye is not satisfied with riches. So this man continues to work and gain riches, is not satisfied with that, and continues to work more and more and more to gain more and more and more. And of course, and we know that's it ends, and that's a grave misfortune. I also wanted to read Ecclesiastes 5:10, this idea of how this man spent his time. When you look at 5:10, he's focused on not being satisfied. Verse 10 in chapter 5 also says the same idea. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. And in Proverbs 27:20, hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied. So if you're basing your life on trying to satisfy, I guess, the desire for riches, you know, if that's your sole purpose, do you ever go, well, I finally got to $2 million. I made it. That's enough. Then I'm just going to drop my work. Is that what happens?
You're satisfied. Then you got to worry about the $2 million or whatever money you have.
Yeah.
You keep it.
But just maintaining it, but then even those people who
more
focus their lives on that, focus all their energies on that, you know, you can kind of say that, you know, just this isn't scriptures, but yeah, if you focus your entire life on gaining and possessing, you're working to get all this stuff, and when you finally say, yeah, I've made it to whatever amount, say, I was working, this is my goal, $2 million, $5 million, whatever, some excessive amount, you get there, what do you have besides that money? You know, this man had nothing, no family. Probably, you know, will you just stop and shift your focus? If your priority has been that priority for so long, it's probably going to continue to be your priority. And you're just going to keep on, and then plus the fact we see in these scriptures, man's not satisfied once he even gets, you know, to, I've got enough. No, it's still not enough. Just never enough. You just keep going. And so, this desire for riches continues, you know, drives their lives. And I was going to best as, just like Mr. Fonda mentioned about Mattress Matt. I know he's got a lot of money. And he's getting up there in age where I'm sure he could have retired quite a long time ago, and I know he has family. But he's still at work on a Saturday night, working away. I don't think I would be doing that, but then I don't have that life, and I'm not driven by that same matter. It is a temptation any of us fall into. If we did that, we might end up in that same place. Anyway.
Michael, with an observation here. Notice you got verses 7 through 12 grouped together, which I agree with you. In the New American Standard, verse 7 is in bold. Verse 9 is in bold. Which they're trying to tell you they think that's paragraph divisions. But if it's as you've got it, which I agree, this certain man without the verse says dependent. You've already observed that that's not necessarily talking about son. In fact, the marginal note says literally a second.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And our translators sometimes try to help us and they really hurt us. Why put dependent? Could it be a wife? Could it be just a friend?
Yeah.
If they're grouped together like you had it, it could be somebody you sleep with, verse 11. So here's my question, if it could apply to a companion in the sense of a mate, could two people be married, share the same house, but fit the description that's in this text?
So could someone actually have a companion but still fit this description? I believe so. Just because you're married doesn't mean you have companionship. We see that a lot. Well, I'm sure that's been this case throughout time. So the people get married, and I have a companion, but then if you don't ever spend time with that person, are you really a companion? Now, if you're off at work 12 hours a day, come home, sleep, go back to work again, you're alone at work. Anyway, yeah, so that's a good point. I mean, I discussed friends, yeah, this companion, no second. This man, it's all inclusive. This man is alone. You know, he's isolated himself from everyone around him because of his focus. So he's cut off family, cut off whatever friendship, anyone who could be there with him. And we see that it is a grave misfortune. It's an evil task. And we discussed evil before. This isn't the evil of, you know, violation of God's will. It's morally reprehensible. It's just grievous, painful sorrow to oneself. And it fits. I believe it fits right in with this next bit we're about to get into, beginning in verse 9. You see, here we've been discussing the man alone, completely alone, and then it stops, or it doesn't stop, but it goes right in and says, look, now let's look at two. Let's look at someone who does have companionship. Beginning in verse 9, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls. For he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm and alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. And so here we see the grievous task of a man being alone. And so here we have a man who is not alone. And it's better. And so, why is it better in these scriptures, in verse 10? Why is this man better for having a companion?
You fall down, your companion will lift you up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get into trouble, you have someone to help you out of trouble. And, you know, of course, you know, events in our lives are not always based on the decisions we make that lead us there. Sometimes events are just those events that happen. Tree fell on my house. I didn't make that happen. But, you know, we had insurance and so forth. But, you know, back then, tree fall on your house, you're going to have to build your house by yourself. If you have a companion, it helps. It's a little a bad analogy, but, you know, that's the sense of it. Is there's someone there to help you up. Maybe you fall into a pit back then. It's tough to get out of a pit on your own. But if someone on the outside, they can have access to the things you need to get you out. It's you have someone to help you there, no matter what befalls. In verse 11, what does it give?
Keep warm, number one.
Yeah, keep warm. You're sleeping tonight. You ever get cold and you don't have a blanket? You know, we don't live in the area they live in. There's more arid, but in the deserts, you know, it gets colder at night. And I was reading something about they don't have good insulation like we do now either. Nice warm beds, but yeah, when you're at night and you can catch, when you get cold, you catch ill. It can lead to disease or illness and death. And of course, just the fact that it's mighty uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to sleep when you are shivering. Yeah, but this one, with a companion, you have someone to keep you warm. And it doesn't have to be, you know, it's not talking about, certainly your companion is your wife. You have someone to keep you warm. I think just one point that sprung to mind, it could be anyone, though. If you're traveling, I think in each of these cases, it could be as a sense of, you know, someone traveling the road of life. You're traveling, you're going in a place you don't know, you fall into a pit or a ditch. There's someone to help you out. You're traveling, you're on the road, you're cold. You bundle up with whoever's with you to stay warm, you know, whatever travelers it may be. I was thinking, one other point in the scriptures that's mentioned of to keeping warm at night, David, when he's old and aged, I didn't write down the verse, it wasn't too important, but there was a point where he said he couldn't stay warm, no matter what happened, so they brought a virgin to him to lay with him in just that sense, just to keep warm, and he never knew her. And so here, you know, it's nothing but that essence of staying warm through the night. I must have had thin blankets back then. In verse 12, what do we see?
Protection.
Strength. Strength and protection. You know, it, back to that sense of if this is someone traveling, you're going down the road, and some raiders or whoever, some men attack you, one alone, if there's more than one of them, you can easily overcome. Even if it's just one-on-one, they have the upper hand. They surprise you, you're subdued. But if there's two, well, two against one are better odds. You have a greater chance of fighting off whoever is coming at you. It's the idea of, there's more strength in numbers, power in numbers. So he can't be overpowered. And also, he mentions a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Just the idea of strength with increased numbers. So is this a profitable case? Does this mean if you have companions, you are safe through life? So I head nod. Why not? You nodded your head.
No? I don't want to be the one
that's... Well, someone else can
answer
for you. Yeah, we see the case, you're better off. You're better off. It's not profitable. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, we saw these cases where, you could be helped. You could be helped in a time of trouble. You could stay warm. But it doesn't guarantee those things, does it? You say, we're strength in numbers, you're less likely to be overpowered, but it's a less likely. There's no guarantee. And, events happen. You make companions, you make friends. What's possible to happen after that? Rocky?
I want to comment on the scriptures here. So the point that Saul is trying to emphasize is that, relationships, companionships are important. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to note that evidently we've been designed by God to have relationships and companionships. Man was alone, brought woman, mm-hmm. to be a companion for life. You look at the local church, God made that design for each other to have these relationships to help each other out. We have elders who are looking out for us, and so it appears to me that that's part of our nature, that we need, designed by God, that we need to have companionships, we need to have these relationships. It's part of who we are, how we've been designed.
Yeah, we gain strength, emotional strength, from being with others versus being alone. And it certainly is better off, and will help us get through life. But like I was saying, it's no guarantee. What is the possibility you make companions, friends? Is it guaranteed they will be there to help you?
No.
No, it's not a guarantee. It's an increased odds. We know. I'm skipping around my life. Anyway, we'll stick on this track for a moment. I missed the point. We get back to it. But you're walking. If you're traveling, you fall into a ditch. What happens if he falls in right after you? Oh, now who's going to help y'all? If you both fall into the same trouble, you might still be better off with someone helping you out of the trouble, but if you're both in the same trouble, you might have to rely on someone else to get you out of the pit. You make companions, hopefully you make good ones, and they're there with you, but companions can desert you. They can't abandon you. And there's the one thing that happens to us all, death could rob you of your companion when you need him the most. So, there is no lasting profit. I don't want to bring everyone down, but mm-hmm. but yeah, it's no guarantee. It's it is still whatever benefit you have is still fleeting benefit. It quickly passes away. No lasting profit. I want to go back to the point I skipped, where we were talking about. I said riches have here, what riches can't do. Before we saw the man alone, he spent all his time focusing his time and energy on obtaining riches, and he probably gathered great wealth. And we saw that it was vanity, and we look and we see companionship is better. You go back and look at that man who is alone, compare the things why man was better with companion, the help in a time of trouble, the helping, keeping you warm, the protection and strength in numbers. Can riches give you any of those things? Are they an equivalent?
Mm-hmm.
No, they're not. Riches don't keep you warm. They can't help you in the time of trouble. Matter of fact, usually people who have riches, their time of trouble is when they lose their riches. And protection, they certainly can't protect you. Someone had a lot of money, could hire bodyguards or whatever, but then you're losing your riches, and what's to say they don't turn on you anyway? Well, this guy's got a lot. Let's just take his stuff. And it ain't gonna stop the people who are, you know, say thieves. They're about to attack you. Wait, I got all the money. Here you go. Take it. And leave me alone. No guarantee. They're there to take it anyway and do what they want. They're in power. So there's no, it doesn't afford you any protection. And so that comparison, I thought it was important to bring up. David, you had a question?
Yeah, somebody this weekend told me, you know, whenever you go through trouble, you always have a companion. Well, a lot of rich people, seems especially nowadays, they'll get divorced, and what do they have left? Just their riches. When they wish they could have never had that divorce, and they would have gladly traded all their riches for the relationship, you know, Laura, I might have.
Yeah.
So that's just something that stuck in my head this week, and that could apply to the scriptures here. Is, you know, you have your mate. What good are the riches? You know, you should stick with your mate.
Yes. Yeah. We go back and we see that someone may have had a mate, and they focused all their energy on obtaining riches. They lost that companionship, and now they are alone with their riches. And those choices to focus their energy on that would better serve to focus on obtaining companionship, maintaining that companionship, you know, in case of marriage or in any case you have, you, so you wouldn't end up isolated. Anyone else have any other comments? Very clear, right? Excellent job, teacher.
Very clear, excellent job, teacher.
Okay. And so I think I made all the points I have about that. We know there is no lasting profit, but companionship is better. It does have some temporary profit, or not, I don't want to say profit, but it has some temporary advantage as we live this life. It's not profitable in the end. And we move to verse 13 through 16, the end of this chapter. And I label it as discussing popularity. And the wording here is rather tricky to use. We got thrown off earlier last class with some pronouns, and they get even worse here. But when we look at verse 13, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. And here's the beginning. We just see a poor and wise youth, and we have a foolish king. And we see this again, this term better. Some, one thing is better than the other. Why is it better for to be the poor and wise youth than the rich and foolish king?
Because if you're young, you can receive instruction, but if you're old, you're stubborn and set in your ways.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. You're going to make some people in here mad.
I heard you, teacher. Good job.
Yeah, you're on the right trail. the old and foolish king, he will not be admonished. He will receive, depending on your verse, mine says admonished, other translations say instructed. He won't receive any more instruction. And how, if he's already foolish, how does one get wise?
Listening to instruction.
Yeah, listening to instruction. Listening to someone else who knows, who can instruct you. So this foolish king is going to stay foolish. I don't think he's not being instructed because of his age. I think it's because he's the king. You know, the king is the one in power and one authority. Who goes up to the king and says, "You are wrong. You need to fix it."
My daughter does.
I mean, you know, you don't rush into your boss's office, throw open the door. You know, that decision you made was, maybe some people do that in the privacy of the office, and maybe they have an open door policy. But if your boss makes a decision in front of in a conference with other people, and you jump up and go, "That's wrong! Wow, stupid!" in front of everybody, that's not going to go down well, because, that's the pride getting in there, and you know their authority, but you're disrespecting their authority. But, yeah, it's just a sense. The king, he is the one in power. He's the one in authority. People are going to be less likely to tell him where he's wrong. You know, you ever heard of a yes man? We have those at work. The yes man always agrees with the boss. Yeah, you're right. That's the smartest decision. Wow. You are so intelligent. I'm glad you thought up this stuff, even if they don't agree. It's, you know, just sucking up to the boss. Because the boss is the one who has the most, has the authority to promote them or and give them advantages in some way. And I think that's what he's saying here is, you know, here's the king. And he's not going to be, he's already foolish and he's never going to get wise. It's better to be that wise poor youth than that foolish, admired king. The king usually is admired or respected, at least to his face. But he's not going to receive any more instruction. And so if the king's already foolish, and he's not going to get any better, are people going to like the king? Is everyone like our president? Nope. It was a popularity contest that got him voted in to some extent. But it doesn't mean he has 100% across the board
support.
Yeah, support. So he's not liked 100% across the board. Not everyone's totally on his side. Well, here we, you know, the kings, they're not elected by popularity, but if he's foolish, a foolish king, his popularity is certainly going to wane because of his foolish decisions he's going to make. He's going to do things that nobody likes. And that's not in the scriptures. I just thought of that. But when we read into verse 2, wrong chapter. Verse 14. And 14 through 16 says, I'll read the first part. Then the old and foolish king will be admonished no more, for he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come after will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and grasping for the wind. And so what makes believe we're talking about popularity here, we're talking about in 16, it talks about those who would come after will not rejoice in him. That's, I think, the idea of popularity, of being liked. If you're liked, everyone's rejoicing you. Everyone, why, you're great. If you're not liked, that's what we have here. No one's going to rejoice in your name. We also see that this in verse 15, they were with the second youth who stands in his place. The masses were with him. They were, you know, they stood beside him. They were liking him. And so that brings the idea, this idea of popularity. And of course we all know what popularity is. I like to define things just to get everything clear. Merriam-Webster's dictionary, it's that which is suitable to the majority, or it's commonly liked or approved. So here we have a mass, the majority is approving of this person or of this practice or whatever. It's liked by the common masses. And so, you know, we look more closely at this and we start to get, you can get thrown by the pronouns of the he's and who that's referring to. Verse 14, I think, the he here is, for he comes out of prison to be king. We're talking about the poor and wise youth. The king is already the king. And although he comes out to be king even though he was born poor in his kingdom. So here we see the shift of popularity, right? I mean, who really supports the king? I mean, he has the power, he has authority, but as one man, what does he really have? He only has that power and authority if the people are willing to give it to him, right? Or say maybe you separate the people, you separate into the common people and then the army. Oh, well, you know, even the common people don't like him. If he has the army, he's still got the authority, but if you talk about the whole masses, everyone, the army, you know, the physical force behind the kingdom and the people, if they all turn against the king, is he going to remain king?
Not
if there's a coup. If everyone's against you, there's a coup. There's an uprising against the king, and he's one man against many. He's not going to stand. I think that's what we're seeing here is not necessarily a coup, but just the shift of being liked, the shift of popularity moves that the poor wise youth is promoted up. And all the living who walk under the sun, that's everyone, is with him in his place. But you see in the end that there's no end of all the people over whom he was made king. So here he was made king. Now he's over everyone. He was made king because of those he was liked, or because of it, everyone's common approval of him. But what happens in the end? Those who come after him will not rejoice in him. You know, they say, fame is fickle. That you're liked now, but when people's change over time, or you know, just generation people pass away and the new generation comes along, whichever way you shoot it, that your popularity, your approval is going to shift. It's going to change. Bush, after 9/11, had one of the highest approval ratings. And near the end of his service as president, he was really, really down there. No one approved him anymore, even though these same people greatly approved him in the beginning. Allegiances shift. Popularity shifts. Rocky, I think you had a comment?
I've got some question marks on pronouns. I wasn't paying attention to that before, and now I just wonder what it is. I think the point you're making is still the same, but maybe another possible interpretation here. In verse 13, you right to stand the word instruction and the word warning. So this foolish king is not no longer receive warning. Mm-hmm. That indicates that there potentially is a problem on the horizon, so he's not listening to that.
Yeah.
So as a result of that, verse 14 is something's happened. He loses his kingship. So someone's come out of prison to become king. And this the one who's done that is the second lad. But I just throw that out. But whatever, I think the point is still the same about popularity.
I missed that last part. I didn't know where you're going. I understand you're saying that the whole point is the same, but...
The whole point, I think there are three people. There's two lads, and there's the king. The foolish king gets replaced by the second lad. The second lad is the one that's come out of prison to become.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. So there's...
But whatever. I mean,
yeah. There's the first youth, and then there's another youth that comes out of prison.
And then he replaces the king, because the king didn't receive instruction.
Yeah.
Then his popularity wanes. So, same point.
Yeah, I didn't want to get all analytical and hung up on it, because I started looking, I'm like, ah, man. Mm-hmm. I was like, I see the point it's trying to make. I'm just going to skate across the details and stick to the point.
Your illustration is interesting, Michael. I thought about it the same way. If it's applicable with Bush, the main point you're making is the thing to focus on, the popularity is fleeting, because the second lad may be esteemed wise when he's not. Mm. Still, even if he's not, if the people esteem him wise,
mm-hmm.
What happens to the popularity of the other guy? And that's what happened with Bush. People esteemed his successor wise, and he was about as foolish as you can get.
Yes, your public opinion is not always accurate. So. Anyway, end it all. Popularity is vanity and fleeting. It's temporary and they